KBOO, Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on, the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala, bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationship to each other and the living world. We establish and support harmony within ourselves and set the stage for praxis.
This is Rising Up with Sona Ali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Sona Ali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll examine the Supreme Court's likely ruling overturning the right to an abortion. Our guest, Amy Littlefield, is the abortion correspondent for The Nation. We'll delve into what went wrong and how groups are gearing up to move beyond Roe versus Wade. Then we'll turn to author and academic Gio Marr about his new book, A World Without Police: How Strong Communities Make Cops Obsolete. We'll explore how police are part of the problem of violence and danger in a society, how abolishing police is possible, and what it would take to make it a reality. That's coming up in just a moment. Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The United States Supreme Court has indicated that it is leaning strongly toward ruling in favor of an abortion ban in Mississippi. Of the six conservative justices on the nation's highest court, three have been appointed by former President Donald Trump, tipping the balance against reproductive justice. In allowing the Mississippi ban to stand, which the majority seems inclined to do, justices will necessarily undermine the constitutional right to an abortion. This, even as a new Morning Consult political poll shows that a majority of Americans support a right to an abortion. Troublingly, that same poll found that few Americans have heard of the serious threat to the Roe versus Wade precedent. My guest is Amy Littlefield. She is the nation's abortion access correspondent and a journalist who focuses on reproductive rights, healthcare, and religion. Her latest articles include a story for the New York Times Sunday Review titled, What Went Wrong? How the Abortion Rights Movement Failed to Stop the Erosion of Roe versus Wade. And her latest for the Nation titled, Thinking Beyond Roe. Welcome to the program, Amy.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
So before the hearing on the Mississippi case, there was the ruling, or I suppose a lack of a real ruling on the Texas case. Just to get our audience up to speed, can you give us a quick backdrop for what has led up to the hearing on the Mississippi ban?
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think it's easy to lose sight with all eyes on the Supreme Court of the fact that in the state of Texas, since September 1st, you know, the people of Texas have been living under a near total abortion ban. This is a law that was passed to ban abortion after fetal cardiac activity can be detected, which happens around 2 weeks after a missed period. Because of the way that it was written, it outsources enforcement to, you know, what has been described as private bounty hunters, you know, everyday citizens who can sue anybody who aids or abets anyone in seeking an abortion outside of the law. And that meant that sort of gave courts cover to uphold the law and let it go into effect. So, you know, the Supreme Court has really not acted on that case yet to say whether they're going to let the Texas law stay in effect or not. And that's left people in the state of Texas under this sort of marathon emergency crisis that they're facing, where people are having to travel hundreds of miles, to travel sometimes all the way across the country, as far away as California or Massachusetts. And of course, we just don't know how many people in the state of Texas are unable to access abortion care under this near total ban. So that's sort of the backdrop. And then last week, we heard arguments in the Mississippi case, which is concerning a 15-week ban. The Mississippi case was sort of part of this more long-standing incremental strategy by the Christian right to chip away at abortion access over time, piece by piece. And this effort was really driven by a Christian right legal group called the Alliance Defending Freedom, that sought this 15-week ban in Mississippi as part of that strategy to overturn Roe v. Wade piecemeal. And now, of course, with three Trump justices on the Supreme Court, you know, they don't have to wait as long as they may have expected to reclaim all the ground that they want and overturn Roe v. Wade.
So the strategy of the right has been quite successful. They seemed to first pursue a very aggressive state-level strategy to challenge Roe versus Wade, right? And to sort of bring it up at the, to force it to be brought up and challenged to the Supreme Court, while at the same time pushing for Supreme Court justices to be, you know, these conservative anti-choice figures. They had their wildest dreams fulfilled during the Trump presidency, where they didn't get one, not two, but three Supreme Court justices from the, you know, the list of people that they have vetted. Among them, of course, Brett Kavanaugh said that he considered Roe versus Wade precedent. But he seems to now, at least as per the Mississippi hearing, be tilting in a different direction.
Right. I mean, we saw Kavanaugh during the hearings, you know, listing off all of the precedents that the Supreme Court has overturned before and making it seem like he really thought it would be a great idea to do that again. I mean, I think we should take a step back and remember that President Trump, you know, when he was in office, said that what he wanted to do was appoint Supreme Court justices who would overturn Roe v. Wade. That was the priority. It was the priority of the Christian right groups that supported his presidency, you know. And that's what he did, you know, and the Federalist Society and other, you know, right-wing organization has played a huge role here in helping Republicans and conservatives really claim a lot of seats on the federal courts, not just the Supreme Court. And I think these justices were, you know, carefully selected for their stance in opposition to abortion. And so we're seeing the fruits of that, you know, kind of coming up now. for the Christian right. I mean, again, they had this strategy over time to chip away at abortion piece by piece through state legislation. And what happened is that access really eroded, you know, first for low-income people, people of color in states like Texas. You know, over the course of many years, access was eliminated for those people first. And now we're seeing, you know, access being challenged across the board, you know, for anyone who doesn't have the money to, you know, get on a plane and fly to the nearest place where abortion might be available. You know, that's the situation that we could be facing if Roe v. Wade falls. About half the country, half of states would be very likely to make abortion illegal.
And I want to get to what you detailed in your New York Times Sunday Review piece. But before that, do you get the sense that the conservative justices, knowing that the constitutional right to an abortion is popular, or at least a majority supports it, are trying to thread the needle on Roe versus Wade, that they're not explicitly, you know, wanting to come out and say they're overturning that precedent, but they're sort of letting things stand, you know, hoping for rulings that effectively overturn it without explicitly doing so?
Yes, I think a lot of people expected that the Supreme Court would never, you know, challenge such a popular right, or, you know, reverse 50 years of precedent, you know, even though there were many indicators that this is exactly the background of these justices, this is what they wanted to do. I think there was a lot of suspicion that they would sort of try to look reasonable. The Texas law sort of sets them up for that, right? Because if they ultimately end up striking down a law that, you know, appoints your neighbor to be a bounty hunter, in the event that you help someone get an abortion, but they allow the Mississippi law to stand and effectively, you know, gut or overturn Roe v. Wade, then maybe they're going to look reasonable. Whereas, you know, really what Mississippi has asked the court to do is overturn Roe v. Wade. And that would have sounded potentially unthinkable, you know, prior to the Trump administration. So I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of legal experts were surprised by how extreme the justices were sounding last week during the arguments and how willing they seemed to sort of consider overturning Roe outright. You know, for example, when Justice Amy Coney Barrett suggested that it's not really a big deal to have to carry a pregnancy to term because you could just drop the baby off, you know, at the nearest safe haven. Under safe haven laws. Wow. and put the child up for adoption. I mean, that's sort of
not a big deal to have a baby.
Right. I mean, in a country with like the highest maternal mortality rate in the developed world, right? Not a big deal because you can just carry the pregnancy to term and then put the baby up for adoption. I mean, these were the
And this is a woman who has children. And for anybody who's had children.
Seven children, five of which she's given birth to, yeah. Mm. Yeah, so I mean, that's the thing, is she's sort of the dream come true, right? For the Christian right, you have a woman with many children of her own sitting on the Supreme Court who's potentially going to be the one who, you know, overturns Roe v. Wade.
You also, among the things that you've written for The Nation magazine on abortion, took a deep dive into the situation in Mississippi and the what you call Christian legal army behind the Mississippi ban, which it seems like it's sort of been a model for other states as well. Who in Mississippi has been pushing for the ban that is now likely to overturn Roe v. Wade at the federal level?
Right. You know, I think there's this, all eyes are on Mississippi right now and on the last abortion clinic in Mississippi. And it's true that Mississippi is, you know, the state that's defending this law, but the law didn't start in Mississippi, right? It was actually the legal architects behind this 15-week ban were the Alliance Defending Freedom. They wrote this as a model bill. And I went back and listened to, you know, audio from 2018 where their attorney was at an anti-abortion conference talking about how they were going to use this 15-week model bill that had just been introduced, the first one in Mississippi, and they were going to go all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they were going to use this as part of their incremental effort to overturn Roe v. Wade. And once they got the 15-week ban, they'd go for a total ban, you know, except to save the life of the pregnant person. So, you know, that was their long game. That was their plan. Of course, you know, that was in 2018, and a few things have changed since then in terms of the makeup of the Supreme Court, right? So they were able to sort of accelerate those plans. But, you know, I thought it was important in this piece to really draw the connection and to point out the fact that Alliance Defending Freedom, which was founded as sort of the Christian rights answer to the American Civil Liberties Union, it's this sort of broad umbrella group that encompasses a lot of the Christian right legal agenda. They're also the force that's behind the anti-transgender bills that we're seeing in state legislatures, including in Texas and Mississippi, that are cropping up all across the country, bills to prevent transgender students from playing on the sports team that matches their gender identity or from using the bathroom that corresponds to their gender identity. This is literally the same organization that's driving these, you know, anti-abortion and anti-transgender attacks. And one of the things I wanted to do in this piece is point that out, how this is all part of a sort of concerted agenda. And, you know, I spoke with journalist Amara Jones of Translash. She said this is really the Christian right sort of considers itself to have won already on the issue of Roe. And they're sort of pivoting to another front in the, you know, quote unquote, gender wars or whatever you want to call it, which is, you know, riling their base up around the issue of trans rights instead.
Now, let's talk about how this was allowed to happen, if you will. In the Sunday review of the New York Times, you had an extensive piece about the ways in which our big national high-profile abortion rights organizations failed. Abortion and the right to an abortion, a majority of the American population supports it. Planned Parenthood has a formidable force, or at least that's the impression one gets. So What happened? Can you detail for me how it was that these organizations like NARAL, Pro-Choice America, and Planned Parenthood ended up putting most of their resources into a national fight when the conservative anti-choice movement was putting all their resources into the state-level fights?
Right. And, you know, as a caveat, you know, I want to say there's a lot of explanations and a lot of factors that went into, you know, where we are today. But what I really wanted to do with this Times piece is understand how the movement is being forced to reckon with its own mistakes and where, you know, some of the leading activists and experts in the abortion rights movement are right now in terms of thinking about how we arrived at this moment, which really is a historic low in many ways, you know, with the, you know, very real possibility that Roe is going to fall in the coming months. And so, you know, what I wanted to do is look back at the history and take a look at some of the key moments when I think there were opportunities that were, you know, that you know, experts and activists told me opportunities that were missed that, you know, become painfully clear in retrospect. One really significant moment is that, you know, 3 years after Roe v. Wade, we saw this introduction of the Hyde Amendment, a measure that banned federal funding of abortion, and that meant that it was off limits to people who were on Medicaid in many cases, unless states decided to issue their own funding for that. And in subsequent years, we saw Supreme Court decisions upholding, you know, restrictions on public funding of abortion. Because there was not a fight that was as robust as it could have been right off the bat to push back against the Hyde Amendment, that ban on federal funding really became a normalized part of the budget process year after year after year. And the issue of public funding became sort of a third rail in abortion politics, which reproductive justice groups did a lot of hard work over years to sort of change that. And, you know, notably to get, you know, President Biden to shift his stance on that. He was a defender of the Hyde Amendment, as were a lot of Democrats for a long time. So it was only when reproductive justice groups forced a national reckoning over the fact that this is really a racial justice issue. This is a situation where you're forcing, you know, you're depriving women of color, people on Medicaid, poor people of a right that, you know, people with private insurance or people with money and means, you know, can access. That sort of framing, which has really taken center stage in recent years because of the reproductive justice and Black Lives Matter movements, you know, there's been a real shift in that. But one of the things that I heard when I was talking to people is sort of the missed opportunity that framing, that pushback around, you know, fighting for sort of the people who lost their rights first, how that was sort of a missed opportunity to draw a line in the sand, starting, you know, with the Hyde Amendment in 1976. Now, I do want to say there were efforts to fight back against that. Faye Waddleton, who was the first Black woman to lead Planned Parenthood in 1978, really tried to take a stand over the issue of Medicaid funding, and she got a lot of pushback from within the ranks of her own organization's affiliates. So, that was one of the sort of moments that I think people brought up in terms of, you know, missteps or ways that the movement sort of ceded the rights of the most vulnerable over time.
And so there's this intersection between reproductive justice and racial justice, right?
Exactly. Which I think, you know, quite frankly, over, you know, a lot of decades, the mainstream pro-choice movement was often led by white women, who were not thinking intersectionally, were not always thinking about racial justice, were not thinking primarily about issues like public funding. And I think when the movement said, okay, look, Roe v. Wade is there and abortion is legal, that ceded a lot of ground in terms of what it meant to actually make access real for people who didn't have public funding or who were having to deal with incremental restrictions that were coming out of the states. And so, you know, another issue is that there wasn't the level of investment in state level battles to push back against that legislation by some of these national organizations over time. And if there had been more of an investment, we might have seen, you know, better resourcing for reproductive justice groups in states like Texas to push back against bills like Senate Bill 8, or to, you know, push back against to, you know, sort of invest more in state level elections and change the makeup of their legislatures over time.
So let's talk about moving beyond Roe versus Wade. It seems as though this chapter of a national fight is slowly closing, but that doesn't, of course, mean it's the end of abortion rights. What are some of the ways in which grassroots organizations, where there's always been energy in defending abortion rights, what are some of the ways in which they are either pivoting or re-energizing to, you know, to kind of redo or maybe fill the gap that the national organizations have left?
Reproductive justice groups have always understood that they couldn't rely on the Supreme Court or on Congress, right? And I think certainly when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, you know, that was a moment where the movement really understood it was going to have to regroup and chart its own path forward. And I think, at least in terms of the grassroots organizations that are directly involved in providing care and getting people to care. So I think there's a couple of things that I saw. You know, I was outside the Supreme Court last week when they were hearing arguments inside. And outside I saw, you know, activists having this very energetic 6-hour long rally. And I think there are a couple of things that it seems like the abortion rights movement is really channeling its energy towards. One of them is going to be working out the logistics of getting people the care that they need. So if abortion is going to become illegal potentially in about half of states, then I think there's a question about moving people to those states where it's legal, building up access in states where it's legal, investing in telemedicine, and then also figuring out ways to get medication abortion, so pills that can be used to end a pregnancy, into the hands of people who might not be able to travel out of states where it's illegal. And that sort of brings up a legal gray zone and the potential for criminalization. So there's legal groups involved in that. There's, you know, advocacy groups involved in thinking through those solutions. And I think another part of what I saw, you know, there the rally last week was held under the banner of the slogan Liberate Abortion. And that to me was sort of evidence of, okay, we're not saying to the Supreme Court, please, 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 you know, okay, uphold the 15-week ban, but, you know, don't overturn Roe v. Wade. Instead, there seems to be this sort of shift towards a message of culture change, a message of destigmatizing abortion and, you know, changing hearts and minds and really building the mass movement that's going to be needed to, you know, reclaim the ground that's been lost over time.
I'm so glad you brought up this issue of a cultural shift, because that seems to be, since the Roe v. Wade decision, a front that we haven't moved as far on up until maybe a few years ago, when there's been starting, where there started to be this destigmatization of abortion rights, where, you know, people who've had abortions right. are starting to embrace that and announce it and express mm-hmm. that there's nothing wrong with it. For years we've had right Hollywood tropes of, you know, people who've gotten pregnant and wrestled with the idea of an abortion, mm-hmm. most of the time ultimately deciding not to have an abortion, or if they did, being so torn up about it. And we've right. had this shame, right, around abortion rights. Mm-hmm. And that seems to have been a big missing piece in the national discourse on it. There hasn't been much national discourse beyond, yes, we agree women should have abortions or should be able to have abortions if they want to. It's always been this choice thing rather than a celebration of people being free to do what they want to do with their bodies, right?
Right, right. And I think the abortion storytelling movement, you know, groups like We Testify are really moving the bar on that. And they have this slogan, everyone loves someone who's had an abortion, or everyone loves someone who's had abortions. And they're really, you know, trying to push, like Renee Bracey Sherman, the head of that group, said at the end of the rally, if you've had an abortion and you haven't told people you love, you know, tell them. Because I think that's where this sort of steady incremental change of you know, moving people to participate, you know, maybe people who already are in favor of abortion rights but don't realize they have this personal connection to it, you know, bringing those people into the fight and sort of drawing on the untapped political potential of the 1 in 4 people, you know, who've had abortions, or 1 in 4 women and an untold number of trans and non-binary folks who've had abortions, you know, bringing those people and anyone who loves them into the movement, that really seems to be the target and sort of building that long game over time to push back against this very real threat that's on the horizon.
Is there a move or a push or desire to try to legislate abortion rights? I mean, we've relied on, just going back to the issue of how, yes, grassroots groups are not waiting on Congress to do the right thing because, well, they'll be waiting forever, as we find out on so many other fronts. But Congress and Democrats who claim they're pro-choice and a handful of Republicans have relied far too much on the Supreme Court precedent of Roe v. Wade, right? And have failed to legislate the right to an abortion. Now we're seeing Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren making the case for abolishing the filibuster in, you know, because abortion rights are at stake. Is that, as far as you can tell, a potential for progress?
I mean, I think there's certainly organizing going on to pressure Democrats in Congress to act. There are, you know, measures like the Women's Health Protection Act, and there's also the EACH Act, which would repeal the Hyde Amendment. You know, those measures, there's been momentum from progressive Democrats and for some time. But I think a lot of the most rapidly moving and energetic organizing going on to preserve and even expand abortion rights is happening at the state and even the city level. So in recent years, we've seen cities like New York City, Austin, Texas, Portland, you know, authorizing funding to help people to be able to access abortion at the city level. We've seen efforts by states like my home state of Massachusetts became the first to repeal a parental consent law so that minors would have easier access to abortion. So I think we're seeing, you know, efforts to shore up abortion access and reproductive health care in states and counties and cities where that's possible. And a lot of that is happening, you know, in the same way that's what, when the anti-abortion movement lost to the Supreme Court, they really, you know, put all of their investment into, or a lot of their investment into the state and city fight. And we're seeing that happening on the other side now.
So for those people who are watching and listening to this conversation, who are worried about the threat to abortion rights, and I mentioned there was a poll done where a lot of Americans simply have no idea that the mm-hmm. right to an abortion is so deeply threatened. For those folks yeah. who are realizing that now, would you suggest, based on the journalism you've done, that if they want to, say, give money to abortion rights groups, to pro-choice groups, that they might be better off giving it to their local organization that may not necessarily be affiliated directly, at least, with a Planned Parenthood or narrow pro-choice. Not that those organizations don't deserve the money necessarily, but if a lot of work is being done at the grassroots level, is it worth finding the local groups in one's neighborhood and one's city and supporting them?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly if folks are looking for ways to get involved, it's important to look at what's going on in your own city council, your own state legislature, and understand the groups that are doing that work on the ground. One of the things that I heard, you know, I interviewed a lot of state organizations, a lot of people who are involved in reproductive justice work in Texas, and they all said, you know, they're doing work, they're really underfunded. You know, they're doing things like helping minors who have to go petition a judge for permission to get an abortion if they don't have a supportive parent. You know, they're doing work like that, which is very intense and very emotionally draining, often on a shoestring budget. And so I think, yeah, check out the organizations that are doing that work in your community. I think a lot of times the national groups like Planned Parenthood have absorbed a lot of the resources and political capital and also the responsibility, right? I mean, they have a lot on their plate in terms of their political work and providing, you know, basic healthcare in a lot of places. So, I think one trend that emerged in my reporting is really that the state and local organizations have been comparatively underfunded over time haven't been given necessarily the resources that they've needed in order to wage these very intense battles in state legislatures.
Amy, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post links to your articles in The Nation as well as the New York Times Sunday Review. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. This is a pleasure.
My guest has been Amy Littlefield. She is The Nation's abortion access correspondent and a journalist who focuses on reproductive rights, healthcare, and religion. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The 2020 uprisings for racial justice sparked many questions about the violence that police have wrought on Black and Brown communities for generations. It also sparked on a nationwide level, via the slogan Defund the Police, the radical idea of abolishing police altogether. While many books have been written on the problems of policing to make a case for abolition, there are few that actually tackle what abolition could look like. One of them is a new work by my guest, Gio Maher. Gio Maher is a visiting associate professor at the Department of Political Science at Vassar College and senior research fellow at the Global Center for Advanced Studies. He's the author of 5 books, including We Created Chavez, Decolonizing Dialectics, Building the Commune, Spirals of Revolt, and now his latest book, which he joins me to discuss, A World Without Police, How Strong Communities Make Cops Obsolete. Welcome to the program, Gio.
I'm so glad to be here.
So let's first start with the fact that when we have had discussions around abolition, often it's seen as this radical idea. There is an underlying assumption built into our cultural fabric that of course we need cops. How could we even have a world without cops? Because otherwise we would have chaos. There would be no safety. Who would you call in case of an emergency? I imagine that that's a question that you often face.
Certainly. But we should also remember that, the first wave of abolitionism, where abolition gets its name, in other words, the abolition of slavery, the same could have been said. Slavery was felt to be natural by large segments of the American population. It was unquestioned by large segments of the South in particular. And it wasn't until a very compressed period around and before the Civil War that people began to shift their perspectives radically. And that's what we're talking about today, is really beginning to shift that perspective even more than it already has. And when you do so, you begin to denaturalize institutions like slavery and today like police and prisons. What that means is to begin to think differently, to think about what the world could or would look like without police, to think about what the conditions for a world without police would look like, who would be called, precisely that question, what your, the structure of community would look like, what the relationship between us and our neighbors would look like. And we are unable fundamentally to think seriously about those questions in the world that we have, in a world that is structured around the police, in which police are seen as the solution to every social problem, the persons that you call when you have any kind of conflict, any kind of violence, suffer any kind of theft. These are questions that need to be asked, but it is primarily by beginning to ask them that we can begin to imagine and think differently about what the world could look like.
And how does white supremacy play a role in maintaining this myth that the police are absolutely necessary? There are people who the police do keep safe.
Certainly. The relationship between white supremacy and the police goes all the way back. As many people have noted, rightly, the police have some of their most proximate origins in slave patrols, in sort of white mobs and white vigilantes, in the kind of people who killed Ahmaud Arbery, in the Kyle Rittenhouses of the world. And between the police and sort of white vigilantes, there's always been this kind of tight relationship. But on a more fundamental level, as you point to, I think quite rightly, people experience policing very differently. People in wealthier, well-resourced neighborhoods experience policing very differently. In fact, they don't interact with the police nearly as often as people in over-policed, hyper-policed neighborhoods, in which the police enact repression and violence every day. And so the racial divide on policing is very, very real, and we see it in the consequences. We know that the police don't protect communities of color. They inflict huge amounts of violence on them. And what I try and show in the book is there's actually far more communities that are left unprotected by the police. People who are unhoused, living on the street, are subject to immense amounts of police violence. Women are not protected by the police. They're actually the objects of police violence as well. People suffering mental health crises, poor people. There are so many communities that even might believe that they're protected by the police, but when you look at the concrete facts, they really aren't.
So you write in your book, as we will see, the police don't actually help. They don't prevent violence, and they don't make any measurable contribution to public safety. If anything, what the police are most adept at is eating up billions of dollars in resources that could be repurposed to build truly secure communities. And of course, that was the sentiment captured by the idea of defund the police when Black Lives Matter, other racial justice organizations, put this call out. By defund the police, they meant fund social services, fund those things that make our communities strong, right?
Absolutely. If we can sort of statistically demonstrate, for example, that the police do not make communities safer, we actually can't statistically point to what the world would look like in a far more ambitious way if we withdrew those funds from the police and dedicated them to building more egalitarian society, and dedicated them on a sort of fundamental and primary level toward early intervention to prevent violent conflict in communities, right? Or social welfare programs, or employment programs, education programs, the kind of things that poor communities are lacking, and that as a result lead to the kind of activities that are, that are closely associated with intra-community violence. And when we talk about making police obsolete, this is more than just abolishing the police. Abolishing means tearing down an institution. As Angela Davis has said very clearly when it comes to prisons, to make an institution obsolete is to create the kind of world in which that institution makes absolutely no sense. So in a world of equals, in a world that is not structured by socioeconomic inequalities, vast inequalities, in which people are not homeless, are not going hungry, they have work, they have housing, in a world that is not structured by racial inequality, by gendered inequality, inequalities, why would we need the police? Because precisely what the police do is to uphold and patrol those boundaries that divide our societies. So insofar as we're building more equal communities, and again, in the short term, directly targeting with community organization the prevention of violence, we will begin to see through defunding that communities are getting safer, not more violent.
You include the cases of Ahmaud Arbery and Kyle Rittenhouse, who you just cited. Ahmaud Arbery being, of course, the victim of violence in Georgia, and Kyle Rittenhouse being the perpetrator of violence in Wisconsin. Those two trials wrapped up just as your book is coming out, the trial of the killers of Ahmaud Arbery, the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse. But neither of those actually directly involved police. So why are they part of the story?
I mean, as I argue in the book, the system of policing is far broader than the institution of uniformed police. When we say that Ahmaud Arbery was not targeted by the police, he was still being policed. He was being surveilled, he was being surrounded, chased, pursued by self-deputized police, in other words, white vigilante. And when we say vigilante, we need to be absolutely clear about this. We're not trying to draw a line between the Kyle Rittenhouses of the world and the police. Kyle Rittenhouse wanted to be a cop. That was his goal in life. And that was what he was doing when he picked up a weapon and went to commit. And the same can be said of the murderers of Ahmaud Arbery. They were doing police work from the very beginning, more than 150 years ago. That has been the work of the police, to oversee, to surveil, and to oppress Black and brown and poor communities. That's what they were doing. They were doing the work of the police, whether they're called it, or not. And we see the same thing in cases of sort of Trayvon Martin and many others who were actually killed by white vigilantes. We see it in a far broader system that involves district attorneys, that involves police, judges, that involves juries of largely white everyday citizens who either decide to charge the subjects of police violence, Black and brown and poor people in particular, or decide not to press charges against officers or white vigilantes who have killed people unnecessarily. This is long been the complicity, and we see it playing out in these cases as well.
Let's dig into the meat of how police maintain their power. We see in city after city, because of course policing happens at the city level, we see often progressive DAs or mayors, people who we might imagine have power to hold the police accountable, fail to do so. New York City might be an example, with Bill de Blasio promising to take on the police. Of course, he himself was a problematic mayor in many other ways. But we see, in Los Angeles, where I live, Eric Garcetti failing to have much power over the LAPD. You point out that police unions, and others have pointed this out too, are such a huge part of the issue. So how do police unions maintain police power?
I think if people knew what police unions do every day, they would be utterly scandalized, because what they do is to bully local officials, to bully state level officials into building the police into our life every day, and building their role into city budgets, extorting more money every year, ever-increasing budgets, ever-increasing salaries. And on top of that, the fundamental thing that police negotiate for, whether it be the local, state, or federal level, is impunity. They don't want to be held responsible for the violence that they inflict on the community. This is what police unions do. They do it by, building, by negotiating binding relations, binding arbitration on the local level, negotiating directly with city officials. Sometimes this is enshrined by state law, as it is in Pennsylvania, for example. They do it through state level laws called Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, which are special rights, not equal rights, special rights for police officers that everyday citizens don't enjoy. This is the kind of thing that makes it very difficult to push back on police power. And when, whether it's elected leaders or private citizens begin to push back, what they find is actually even more terrifying. They find threats of violence, coercion. There are cities that have attempted to push back on police power, and city officials, elected officials, have had their tires slashed, have been threatened, with violence. There have been cities that had to declare bankruptcy and financial emergencies to even begin to think about pushing back on police budgets. And of course, de Blasio, who I have no love for, is a great example of someone who, without even really beginning to seriously threaten police power, was targeted, was harassed, his children were harassed, the city was bullied essentially to give the police whatever they want, because this is what the police do. And they operate, as I argue in the book, as a gang, as a protection racket that doesn't actually protect. And this is precisely part of the reason that they need to be abolished, because there's no possibility of reforming the way that the police operate.
Let's talk about Minneapolis, where your book actually opens, which was the flashpoint, the epicenter, if you will, of the uprisings in 2020 around racial justice and trying to hold police accountable. You point out in your book, you point out that moment when a very angry group of protesters took on police power in a collective way, in a way that was quite violent, in a way that maybe indicated the desperation that they feel from being unable to break police power. Why is Minneapolis such an important example? And then all of those incidents and policies that attempted to be enacted in the city afterwards in terms of defunding the police, what does the example of Minneapolis teach us?
I think, as we know very well, that when the citizens of Minneapolis stood up with bravery, with dedication, they proved, to the world how serious this question was. They helped to spark rebellions and resistance nationwide. For example, where I live in Philadelphia, there was a mass rebellion in response to the Minneapolis rebellions, and global responses, the tearing down of statues of colonizers, of slave masters worldwide, all based on the brave example of what happened in the streets of Minneapolis. And yes, the burning down of the Third Precinct was a great example of that. Why? Because in polls immediately afterward, the majority of those polled said that it was a pretty reasonable response, a very direct response to the infliction of violence on the Black community of Minneapolis. Now, what we've seen since has been the question of how do we make this a reality? Immediately, this proposal, which was backed up by the City Council of Minneapolis, was stalled. It was stalled by an unelected commission, that oversees the reform of the charter in the city. And we saw finally 1 year later, after the city was bullied for a full year into accepting the police, into not voting, not voting to abolish the police, the city still 1 year later almost voted to dismantle the Minneapolis police. And I think we should take that as a pretty powerful indication that that change is necessary and is coming soon. But the main thing is to understand that Minneapolis also comes at the head of and as the culmination of long waves of resistance. We're talking about Trayvon Martin, of course we're talking about Oscar Grant, we're talking about in the immediate context Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and we're talking about a moment in which organizers who have been struggling against the police for years now have developed a new language for the defunding and ultimately the abolition of the police, and push that language into the mainstream. This is precisely what's new about Minneapolis, and this is why we're talking about defunding today. It is only, and this is a consistent phenomenon, it is only because of the bravery of people in the streets that we're actually even having these conversations in the mainstream today.
And of course, we have to talk about diverting funding from police towards strengthening communities as part of what abolition requires. So what did Minneapolis offer in terms of a teaching moment for other localities, for other cities, and even for a future Minneapolis with perhaps a different city council or a different dynamic around police unions? What can be learned about doing that work? Because as you were saying, there was a moment when the institution of slavery seemed accepted, and it was unimaginable that it would no longer be. And it is possible to imagine a world without police, and stepping into that requires the money, right? That the money be diverted.
Absolutely. And again, if the historic experience of the abolition of slavery teaches us anything, it's that abolition is always a reconstruction. Otherwise, it will fail. And with the failure of reconstruction after the Civil War, many former slaves were pushed directly back into the kinds of relations that had existed under slavery, the kind of organized white supremacy, the kind of economic exploitation. Why? Because you do need to build that alternative world. Now, Minneapolis was very interesting, is that here was a moment in which It was not a question of doing the slow building of alternatives. It was a question of the immediate potential to abolish the police. But what did communities on the ground do? Very quickly, they organized a security perimeter. They organized a security committee to keep the protest zone safe without the police in Minneapolis. Very quickly, people took over a hotel and turned it into collective housing. Very quickly, in other words, people began to catch up with what was happening on the very public level and began to build those alternatives as quickly as possible. What's been happening since is kind of the inverse. People nationwide have been building these alternatives, have been developing alternatives to the police at the same time that they're pushing defund efforts in cities, that they're attempting to withdraw those funds, because what we need to do simultaneously is to build autonomous alternatives and to demand that those, you know, those millions and indeed billions of dollars that are being dedicated to the police be handed back over to communities so that communities can use them democratically on the grassroots level to build real communities again of equals, communities of safety, communities of collective security in which people don't feel vulnerable and so don't need to call the police.
Let's take on an issue that you discuss in your book where the reformist versus abolitionist breakdown sometimes happens, which is when we want to hold police accountable, you know, those police who are perpetrators of violence, we often end up applauding when the criminal justice system holds them accountable, which is, of course, quite rare when that does happen. But when it does happen, many of us, even those who might support abolition, feel at least there is the same standard being applied to police versus the rest of us, and therefore it is a step in the right direction. Where do you fall on this issue of seeing, you know, sort of rejoicing in the fact that the criminal justice system, when pushed, might occasionally hold police accountable for violence, hold them to the same standards as some of us are held to?
Certainly. I mean, when the murderers of Ahmaud Arbery were convicted, that did not represent justice. Were Kyle Rittenhouse convicted and sent to prison, that would not be justice. At the same time, I think it's important to understand that, as you put it quite rightly, people do react to the fact that, you know, that poor communities of color are not given the same levels of access to just to so-called justice by the system, and they do of course react angrily when that's not the case, when charters are not, you know, pressed, and they do demand, I think quite rightly, that, you know, that people like Derek Chauvin be put on trial. The question for me fundamentally is more about, you know, what kind of structural responses you know, can be developed, and what kind of movement power are we building, are we developing through these cases? I don't think anyone in Minneapolis thinks that convicting Derek Chauvin was justice being served. I think people realize that there is a long path ahead. And that path involves a whole range of other organizing and other, you know, processes. And of course, this demand, the proposal to dismantle the police is a key part of this.
Well, so, then what would again, justice look like? Would it be no more future George Floyds being killed, right?
Yeah, no, justice for George Floyd's family is that he would not be killed, that he would not have been targeted, that he would not have been subject to that violence. And it's the building of a world in which this is not going to happen in the same way that it does, which is necessarily a structural task. Again, I don't think we can blame people for rejoicing. I don't think we can blame people for demanding some level of equal justice, even if we know that the system is not going to actually provide justice. The justice is going to come outside of that system. The justice is going to come through the radical transformation of that system. And again, we're not against all changes. You know, there are, of course, great abolitionist scholars and organizers who have developed, you know, criteria for saying which changes, which reforms are potentially radical, potentially abolitionist, can we support, right? We support real oversight that weakens police power. We support defunding if it really withdraws funding from the police. We support any change that withdraws police from communities and limits and minimizes interaction with those communities. What we cannot support are reforms that put more money in the hands of the police. We cannot support reforms that give the police more power to investigate themselves, for example. You know, and here the broad range of reforms that we're often told will be the magical solution to police violence are, you know, are absolutely the opposite. Mm-hmm. Body cameras do not help with police violence. You know, so-called community policing is the destruction of communities. It doesn't help with police violence. The real solutions come from that community organically pushing the police out and taking over the maintenance of its own safety and security.
So reforms that are steps toward abolition in a very clear way, chipping away at police power and funding, are in service of abolition, and anything that goes in the opposite direction but cast as a reform is something that abolitionists often will call out.
Yes, it's a question of power. At the same time, even those reforms, we need to be very wary, because the system is prepared and always on the offensive, looking for ways to reincorporate even those changes into a new and, you know, a newly functioning system. So abolition really is a total project. It's something that demands a radically different world. It gains and derives its power from that demand, from insisting that we focus on that horizon. And yet concretely every day we do need to be fighting for changes. So we need to prioritize those changes that really transform the structure of power, that strengthen communities and that weaken the police.
Gio, you wrote a book about Venezuela. You have written, you've actually taught, I understand, in Caracas, capital of Venezuela. What did you learn about how some communities on the ground in a very different country might offer some lessons for abolitionists here in the United States?
As I argue in the book, we need to understand abolition, in a global way. We need to understand policing as a global phenomenon that's directly connected to the U.S. global imperialism, global power, that's connected to global capitalism and the ways that it manifests globally. And for me, as I explain, in the book, these never seemed separate to me. When I was living in Caracas and studying grassroots self-defense movements that were taking over their community, that were pushing the police out, that were building collective democratic structures for their own self-government. I was also going back and forth to Oakland, California, of course, the birthplace of the Black Panther Party, which was again the Black Panther Party for self-defense, which sought not only to oversee activities of the police, but also to provide for the social welfare of the community, also to make sure that that elders got to the bus safely. These were all parts of building a community fabric that would be capable of existing without the police. And I think that is a global struggle.
You also in your book link the abolition of police with the abolition of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and borders. Why does that one naturally follow into the other two?
The expansion historically of the U.S. border has been a police project. It's been a project which, again, linking back to the previous elements of the conversation, is connected to the expansion of white vigilantes, settlers taking over territory, enacting violence on indigenous peoples and genocide, and then using that as a pretext for the annexation and the seizure of those territories, the seizure of northern Mexico. This is all an imperial project, and it's a policing project. And it's a project of settler colonialism. They emerged at the same time. And of course, there's no way, even if we didn't understand that historical background, which makes it perfectly clear, there's no way to ignore the dramatic expansion of border policing on the southern U.S. border in particular, but also globally, and to understand, there's no possibility of ignoring the dramatic expansion of border detention. And so we gain nothing from separating these phenomena and the various movements that spread across the country a couple of years ago, the abolish ICE, occupy ICE type movements, were very important in pointing out these connections, which have been deepening in the years since between Black Lives Matter organizations and border justice organizations and border abolition organizations. The reality is the divisions that we suffer, that we struggle against within the body of U.S. citizenry, in other words, divisions along the racial lines, along lines of economic inequality, are very similar to the border as itself a division of communities, of poor communities. They function the same way. They're used in the same ways by imperial and capitalist power. These are the kind of divisions and barriers that we need to overcome. And again, when we're targeting the police, we need to be targeting ICE. Not only ICE as a relatively new institution and phenomenon, we need to be talking about abolishing Border Patrol entirely. And yes, we need to be talking about abolishing the border, because the border itself, much like the police, claims to be preventing violence when it really is the origin of creating a great deal of violence. And we've seen the hundreds of thousands dead, not to mention the tens of thousands who died attempting to cross through the desert that lay as a result of this violent institution that is the border.
Gio, thank you so much for joining us today. Where can people find out more about the work that you do?
Verso Books is where you can find A World Without Police, and my next book is called Anti-Colonial Eruptions, and it comes out in March.
Thank you again. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
My guest has been Gio Marr, visiting associate professor at the Department of Political Science at Vassar College and a senior research fellow at the Global Center for Advanced Studies. He's the author of 5 books, including We Created Chavez, Decolonizing Dialectics, Building the Commune, and Spirals of Revolt. And we've been discussing his latest book, A World Without Police, How Strong Communities Make Cops Obsolete. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Bus is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
What do we mean when we talk about personality? What is your personality?
It is the way you get along. Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is listener sponsored. That's right. 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBOO independent and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. But right now, during our end of year drive, it's the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us reach our goal of $45,000 by December 31st, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000, thanks to the generous support of the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund for the Oregon Community Foundation. Double the impact of your tax-deductible year-end donation at kboo.fm.